supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Common Space. And today, we're all about education. And we have teachers who had a lot to say outside of the classroom. By the way, I'm Jamie J. from First Person Arts, and I'm here with WHYY's Elizabeth Perez Luna.
Jamie, I thought we would start with some facts. The Philadelphia School District has nearly 300 schools, with a student population of 200,000. That's between districts, charter, and private schools. To teach all those kids, you need about 8,600 teachers. And there's still a shortage of teachers. This is just to give you an idea of how important education is for all of us at every level of city life.
Okay, let's get right into our teacher tales. For students, the field trip is one of the most exciting school activities.
I loved field trips when I was a kid.
Well, Elizabeth, teachers may see it as a great opportunity to learn something new outside of the school. But for kids, it's often a day to just cut loose and drive your teachers crazy. That's why chaperones are so important on field trips. And you know, teachers rely on parents to chaperone these field trips. But what happens when the parents need chaperoning? Jason Pittman told us this story about taking his class to the zoo, which in the end became a bittersweet experience for him.
So I have just completed 10 years as a public school teacher in Washington, D.C. Actually, please don't clap. Don't clap, actually, because I just quit. It was a difficult decision. I hated leaving a lot of my students. I had a student when I was a very young teacher, Brian, in the middle of my lessons would conduct these very wild conversations between his thumbs, who spoke their own thumb language, like, me, 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 me. So when Ryan's mother signed up to be the chaperone of our class field trip to the zoo, I was unhappy. She gets the kids, and we get to the zoo. She walks 20 steps from the entrance. She sits down next to the ice cream vending machine, plops herself down, buys herself an ice cream, announces to the three students that I have conservatively put in her chaperoning group, it's too hot to walk around the zoo today, and just eats ice cream in front of the children and won't buy them any. I find out about this when I was summoned by the zoo staff to the petting area of the zoo because my students from her group have decided to ride the goats in the petting zoo. Now look, I love my students, so I have to justify their behavior a little bit. They're boys. These are boys who have eaten all of the soap in the soap dispenser in my classroom. So like wanting to ride a totally awesome miniature horse, double unicorn pony is like the most well-behaved and normal thing that they've done this year. Look, as a parent chaperone on a school field trip, you have one job, and that is returning to the school with the same number of uninjured children that you started with. We get on the subway, the metro in D.C., the doors close, and Mrs. Hannigan, Ryan's mother, says to me, Beth Pittman, I don't think I have all the kids in my class. I know I'm not supposed to make fun of the parents, but I just quit. So I said, Mrs. Hannigan, please count to three and tell me that you have all of the students in your group. After she gets to two and pauses, I realize we are missing a child, and of course, it's thumbs. She left her own child in the subway station on the last platform. I pull the whole class off the subway, ride back to the other one, pick him up, bring him. We get to the end of the line at the subway, get our cars out of parking. DC Metro has just instituted the Smart Trip card, and you have to pay for everything on the Smart Trip card. She's trying to get a car. The parking lot, but
I don't have a Smart Trip card. I can't get my car out.
I said, no problem, Ms. Hannigan. I'm going to give you mine. You just get a car with that. But
I don't have a Smart Trip card.
Okay, thank you for restating the problem for me. Now I understand much better. So how about this solution? I'll give you mine, and then you can get out. And she said, but it's all I need a Smart Trip card. I don't have. Does everyone in your family only speak thumbs? Meep. F***ing meep, I'll meeping give you mine, and then you'll have... F*** it, forget it. I bought her a Smart Trip card, I give it to her. Get out. Mrs. Martinez, who actually does not speak English, sees this transaction and comes over and asks for her Smart Trip card to get her car out, and I figure, rather I can't do this conversation in English, fine, another $10, here's your Smart Trip card to get out. Ms. Martinez is a responsible chaperone, so she gets $10 out of her wallet to repay me for the Smart Trip card. Unfortunately, hands it to Mrs. Hannigan, asks her to hand it back to me, and of course, Mrs. Hannigan pockets the money. Mrs. Hannigan, however, is not the criminal element of this story, is not the worst chaperone of this story. Because the worst parent chaperone this day got arrested. Mr. Jeffers shows up at the last minute asking to be a parent chaperone. I'm not sure we're going to let dad who just got out of jail be the chaperone for a group of kids, but I tell him, sure, have a little father-son day with your kid. Decides it'll be super entertaining to encourage the monkeys to throw their poo at each other. Causes such a ruckus that he's escorted out by the zoo security. Turns out he has outstanding warrants and is arrested. His son has to walk by himself 10 miles from the police station home that night. It was situations and students like that that kept me in teaching and wanting to be a better teacher for kids like that. It was the adults and the parents and the administrators and the legislators that drove me out.
Jason Pittman left teaching, but he's now working for a not-for-profit aiding other teachers to achieve their missions.
Unless you have been a teacher or are a teacher yourself, this is only a hint of what they go through every day. It's never been an easy job, even in the best of times. Just think of the constant juggling of schedules, curricular, paperwork, bureaucracy, discipline concerns, and persistent lack of funds.
And then you have new Education Secretary Betsy DeVos arriving at her first day at work at the office and asking, where are the pencils? A bunch of teachers in social media unison responded, what pencils?
It's become a sad cliche of how much of their own money teachers spend on supplies for their kids. It's one of the many things they do to balance out shortcomings.
You know, humor helps.
Ah, Jamie, recess.
Have you ever wondered what teachers would say if they could? Well, you only need to go online to find out. We asked producer Mike Villers and associate producer Jen Cleary to read some of these thoughts.
And they enjoyed it.
If I know a pair of students have crushes on each other, I play secret matchmaker and assign them as partners for projects, then sit back and watch the awkwardness unfold.
Every day, I wonder if this will be the day I scream, shut up!
I hate when students tell me about their lives because honestly, I do not care.
I find it hard to be nice to the popular girls because I hated them when I was in school.
I flip off my students when their backs are turned. I teach third grade.
My students are so bad this year that I've gone back to drinking. Again.
I've set my phone to record when I've left the room to hear what my students say about me.
My secret? None of my students realize my husband and I are fully bisexual, and nudists as well. Teachers have lives after the last bell rings, you know.
I'm a teacher, and I smoke weed every day. Even though, you know, of course I tell my students it's really bad for them.
I love most of the kids, but I f***ing hate their parents.
If you want to find out what it means to be a teacher, check this quote from American historian Donald D. Quinn. I like this. He wrote, "If a doctor, lawyer, or dentist had 40 people in their office at one time, all of whom had different needs and some of whom didn't want to be there and were causing trouble, and the doctor, lawyer, or dentist without assistance had to treat them all with professional excellence for 9 months, then you might have some conception of the classroom teacher's job."
Well put. If I had 40 people in the room that I was supposed to treat and many of them didn't want to be there, you'd end up with 39 untreated people.
But a teacher can't do that.
That's
you can't
right.
tell them,
That's
okay,
right.
go home.
And in spite of all the obstacles, they keep on teaching. You got to love them for that.
I did. I went to so many schools here and abroad. That school was a refuge from all the instability at home. And teachers were my anchor to some sort of reality. You know, I remember a science teacher who made amoebas very cuddly under the microscope. Can you imagine? And I also had a teacher that could turn you off to the most wonderful of books.
And sometimes you meet teachers who you're not too sure they even like their students. Storyteller and teacher Emma Hitchcock tells us about her experience teaching English in Russia at a first-person art story slam.
Children scare the crap out of me. I've really come to the conclusion that they're just really cute sociopaths. And if you don't believe me, that's totally fine. But that's been my point of view for a couple decades. So much to my chagrin, when I first moved to Russia, the very first class they handed me was a class of 12 5-year-olds. And I was supposed to teach them English. Two problems with this construct. Number one, I'm not allowed to speak Russian to them because it's an immersion course. And number two, their entire grasp of the English language is limited to the alphabet. So if someone were to craft a special level of hell just for me, that was it. And they were learning, but it was pandemonium every single class because, like pack animals, they could smell the fear. And the ringleader, the alpha male of this, was this little kid, Sasha. And Sasha was one of those kids that was like really bright and really beautiful, and you just knew he was going to grow up to be a giant douchebag. He would interrupt every single lesson 5 or 6 times to show me pictures of his pet rabbit on his cell phone. He was 5. And he would torture the other kids. He'd be like, "You suck, and you can't draw, and you smell like dookie." And so while I'm over here trying to coax a sobbing puddle of child from under one desk, he's like over here ripping up some girl's homework. And that was my life. So I didn't know what to do, so I was like, I'm going to teach them I have. Because I thought kids love to tell you stuff that they have, so this will be great. So I do, and it is. They love it. They can't wait to tell me everything they own. They're like, "I have a yubka." And I'm like, "Skirt." And they're like, "I have a skirt." You know, so it's okay, great. And then there's Sasha. Sasha does not like this game because he is hung up on the phrase, "I am," which gives you a little window into his ego, right? So I'll be like, "Sasha, what do you have?" And he's like, "I am rabbit." And I'm like, "You have a rabbit." And he's like, "I am rabbit." I'm like, "You have a rabbit." And we go back and forth forever until I'm finally so frustrated that I'm like, "I have a better idea." So I draw 2 pictures on my whiteboard, one of him with like the ears and the tail and the teeth eating a carrot, and one of him like holding a rabbit. So I'm like, "I am a rabbit, I have a rabbit, I am a rabbit, I have a rabbit." And the other kids find this hysterically funny because they're 5. But Sasha gets furious because I just embarrassed him. Right, I know I felt bad, but I was like, I'm trying to help. So instead of learning the grammar, he decides to dedicate the next hour of his life to cutting off a chunk of my hair. I hear him tell the other students in Russian, he's like, "I'm going to cut off some of teacher's hair." And they're like, "Why?" And he's like, "Because I like her." Dexter. So every time I go to help a student, I'm like leaning over and I just look over and there's a little Russian psycho with scissors aimed at my head. I kept taking them away. He kept finding more. But I survive, and like a week later, I have 5 minutes left in class, so I decide that I'm going to review. I have. So I go around to each student. I'm like, Sviata, what do you have? And she's like, I have a brother. And I'm like, Stas, what do you have? And he's like, I have a pencil. Stas was really enthusiastic. And I get to Sasha, and I'm like, Sasha, what do you have? And he's like, Niet. Sasha, what do you have? So in my head, I'm like, for the love of God and all things holy, tell me you have a fucking rabbit. But I don't say that. I smile, and I point to his cell phone on his desk, and I'm like, what do you have? And he picks up the phone with a picture of the rabbit on it, and he goes, oh, no, mère. He died. Okay, class over. Bye, kids. And they leave. And it's just Sasha at his desk, like, racked with tears. So I go sit next to him, and before I can even say anything, he just crawls in my lap and hooks his little arms around my neck like a baby monkey and face plants into my cleavage, sobbing. So I'm like, okay. And I have no idea what to do with this because I'm not super well equipped for it. So I'm just like, and I break the cardinal rule of my class. And I'm like, Sashenka, spokojno, vse normalno, like, relax, everything's okay. And he pops out of my bra, which is like now a water bra, and he's like, Vy govorite po-rusky, like, you speak Russian. I was like, you got me. And this big smile comes over his face, and like the tears dissolve, and we like pinky swear that it's our secret to the death, and life is good, right? Because like, I no longer think he's the Antichrist, and he doesn't seem to hate me, so this will be great. So we kind of work this out, and he goes to pack his things, and I go to my desk to put my things away, like humming Eye of the Tiger in my head. And on his way out, he stops at my desk, and he's like, can I have a hug? Sure, buddy. So I go to give him a hug, and just when I should hear that sitcom, aw, what I hear is, shink, and then the sound of scissors clattering to the floor. It takes me a second to process what has just happened. And in that split second, he is gone. Like, I turn just in time to see him careening out my classroom door, brandishing a chunk of my hair in the air like a fresh scalp, screaming, the teacher speaks Russian! The teacher speaks Russian! I don't know if the rabbit actually died and this kid is just, like, a genius opportunist, or if this little f***er set me up from the word go. But what I do know is that was one really cute sociopath.
You're listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. It's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. I'm your host, Jamie Jay, and I'm here in the studio with Elizabeth Perez Luna, and this is our Ode to Teachers. Speaking of disruptive students, not that I would know anything about that. We all know who they are. They know just how to get on their teachers' nerves. Talking too loud and too much, making too many jokes, and mischief at the expense of classroom order. And then there are the kids who bring their problems from home to school. A teacher who knew his students, like Chris Lundy did, realized he could use that knowledge to his advantage.
Okay, so I was a teacher, and I can't prove it, but I had the worst kids in the observable universe. I'm sure of it, I'm telling you. Every time other teachers try to tell me about their teaching nightmare stories, I always ask, did you have Ernest? And if they didn't, obviously, then to me they had it easy. Now, I wasn't very good myself, so I'm sure some of it fell on me. Students were a reflection of their teacher. And, you know, put it like this. Each classroom had a nickname. So there were, like, the champions, the winners. My class was known as the Hot Messes. And we were quite proud of that. What made things worse was I had an old school principal, right? He was big on discipline. Dr. Pinnell, that's all he cared about was class control, discipline. That's all that mattered to him. Test scores were secondary. Discipline is all that mattered. And what was coming up was observation day. Now, this was the one day a year where the big wigs, the executives, would come and observe the school, the classrooms, the teachers, the students, and I guess maybe grade it. I'm not exactly sure what they did with it, but it was a big, big day. As a matter of fact, Dr. Pennell had three meetings leading up to it. The first one was, control your classroom. The second one was, please control your classroom. The third was, if you sons of bitches don't control your class, you'll be filling out COBRA forms a week from now. So it was dead serious. Everybody knew it, and your contract pretty much depended on it. So that day came, and I was a nervous wreck because I knew what I had on my hands. I knew what my class was made of, and I was a nervous wreck. I'm doing things. I'm trying to buy the kids silence. I'm giving them candy, chips, DVDs was the thing back then, just trying to, like, you know, get us through the day. And it was coming up on lunchtime, and no one had visited my classroom yet. And, you know, I'm sitting there, and I'm like, all right, I'm trying to think of things to do, because what lunchtime meant was that I would have to walk my herd of wildlings to the cafeteria, and they saw this as an opportunity to just go buck wild, right? They saw their other friends in the hallway, and I see other teachers nodding their head. Absolutely. It was mayhem. Now, for me, this walk was the Green Mile. It was, you know, dead man walking. And so, but I had an idea. I'm thinking, you know what? If I can get these kids out maybe a little bit earlier while the executives are observing some other classroom, then boom, maybe I can get to the cafeteria scot-free. So I open up the door to make sure the coast was clear. I look to the left, I look to the right, and what do I see? Dr. Pennell with the whole executive team standing in the hallway. They weren't going anywhere anytime soon. I was caught. We were caught. My stomach dropped. I'm thinking about my contract. I'm thinking about the unemployment line. And I looked down because the whole day I had Ernest, who was my absolute worst student. I had him right beside me the whole day. You know that saying, keep your enemies closer? Ernest started that. That's how that all got started. And so I see Dr. Pennell in the hallway with all the big wigs. And I look down at Ernest like, oh, my God. And he looks back at me like, God can't save you now. As soon as you open that door, I'm going full Ernest on your ass. And you've been giving me candy all day. So I knew what I was in for. But just then, an idea struck. And I closed the door, turned into the classroom, and I started laughing hysterically. I mean, busting out laughing. Ah, ha, 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 as loud as I could be. And this got the attention of my kids, and they're looking like, Mr. Lundy, what's so funny? What are you laughing about? And I'm like, no, you know, you guys, you don't want to know. You wouldn't believe me anyway. Don't even worry about it. They're like, come on, tell us, please. You know, tell us what's so funny. I'm like, all right, well, you know, I was just in the hallway, and I heard Dr. Pennell say, he asked, you know, who was the best class in the entire school? And I'm like, hey, it's my class. Of course, it's you guys. And he said, no, I don't think so. I think it's Mr. Shepherd's class upstairs. And I'm like, no, trust me. My class can get from here all the way to the cafeteria in a single foul line without making a single sound. And he was like, impossible. So I bust out laughing. And, well, that's when you guys saw me. So you ready to go to lunch, guys? They took the bait. They start lining up quietly, getting in line. I mean, a perfect little line. But I still had to account for the Antichrist, Ernest. So I kneel down with him. I get eye level. You know how you do. You know, I'm sure everyone who has kids, you get that eye level down to make sure they know exactly, you know, you're serious with them. And I go, Ernest, I need your help. I need you because you're the only one that can do this, because you're the only one who knows karate. And he pauses and he ponders and then he goes, yeah, it's true. And I'm like, Ernest, I need you to lead this line. I need you to get them from here to the cafeteria as quickly and as quietly as possible, and only you can do it. The look in this kid's face, I'm telling you, he was determined. He immediately walked to the front of the line, shoved some kid out of the way, and took his rightful spot as the line leader. So the stage was set. I take a deep breath, I open the door, and I let them go. So they're walking down the hall, and when I tell you guys, you've never seen a line this straight, this perfect. I mean, even their posture, chest out, chins up high, you could balance books on their head. Now, they wouldn't read these books, but they damn sure could balance them on their heads. And it was so quiet. They walked past Dr. Pinnell, walked past the executives, and then I'm following behind them. I get to Dr. Pinnell. He shows me a little wink. I give him one of these numbers. Keep on going. Now, we get to the cafeteria, and it was perfect. Don't get me wrong. As soon as we got there, everything went to shit. I mean, kids started fighting. Ernest vanished. I still don't know where he ran off to. But the deed was already done, and we had done it. And I was proud of him, to be honest with you. So later that year, at review time, performance review time, the annual merit increase that year, faculty-wide, was 2.3%. On my performance, it had discipline and class control as the only two things that were there. But my merit increase was 2.9. So for those of you who do have a drink, please raise it. To Ernest. Thank you.
Chris Lundy is a published writer and a former host of First Person Art Story Slams. Chris was voted audience favorite at every First Person Art Story Slam he ever attended as a contestant.
So, Jamie, I had the feeling that you were talking about disruptive students from experience. So, Chris Lundy had just one disruptive student. But what happens when you have a whole classroom full of them? Well, let's hear from George Dougherty.
So, I am a first-year teacher. Any other teachers in the house? Yeah. Okay, relax. Not everybody's a teacher. Okay. Now, just my whole story will be revolved around the fact that I had ideals before being a teacher of... basically based on different books I read. Nothing they taught me in college because they didn't really teach me anything. But this idea of taking responsibility for your actions. So like this book I read called Punished by Rewards was like, don't give rewards, don't give consequences. The kids should make the right choices without that extra motivation. So I'm like, yes. And the other book I read was Teaching Content Outrageously, which is like, the only reason kids misbehave, so I'm a Philadelphia public school teacher, the only reason they misbehave is because you're boring. You need to really kind of up the drama. So I believe in that, I love that. So I'm a teacher, and just to set up, before my first example, my classroom environment for the first 2 weeks is to the point where it's so chaotic. There's fights, there's throwing stuff, it's so loud that the good students, which is like, you know, I mean, the ones who are behaving at the moment are crying and holding their ears because they're so overwhelmed by the chaos. They cannot take it. There's tears, and it's horrible. And I feel like I'm a cause of that. So that's part of the environment. Another part is like I'm getting hit in the head with the sad part is I could not catch who was throwing the stuff. I would turn the right stuff on the board, whatever, and I kept erasers, pieces of crayon, whatever. I kept getting hit, and I got so frustrated to the point I threw a chair as far as I could against the corner and just said some curse words. But you learn a lot about yourself, my fellow teachers. You learn a lot about yourself when you're a teacher and you, like, anger problems. But anyway, so that's the environment when I'm like, all right, my first opportunity to kind of go outrageous, we're learning about the giving tree. And all right, I'm just going to become a tree for this lesson. And if you're not familiar with the book, The Giving Tree, it's basically about this boy, this tree, a talking tree who's very giving. And the boy just kind of plays with his apples, eats the apples, hangs on the branches, and then uses the branches to build a house, eventually cuts the stump, the whole tree down to make a boat to go away because he's depressed. He becomes an older and older man. And all that's left is this little stump. So this tree has been used and abused, and I'm starting to feel that way as a teacher. But anyway, I come dressed as a tree. I got branches from the park. I'm like having like branches all out the side of my body. And I got, you know, face paint, the whole deal. I'm talking like a tree. I'm like, hey, my name is the giving tree. What's your name? Okay, stop pulling at my branches. Stop hitting each other with the branches. Hey, what are you doing? I think the kids were taking the book too literally. Where in the book, you know, they're kind of using you know, the tree is giving up the branches anyway. So eventually I had to lose the tree voice and start yelling, which doesn't work either. You know that if you're a teacher, it does not work. So I should have learned that, like, the week before where they locked me in the closet. And now, when you get locked in a closet as a teacher, when you actually bust out, like, these kids didn't know me. This was the second week of teaching. And I said to the kid right to their face, "You don't know who I am. You have no idea where I came from or what I'm going to do to you right now. I could have been in jail for who knows what. You better be careful who you lock in the closet." It was now times 10, but you get the idea. So those experiences, but nonetheless, it's hurting. I'm still, next week, I'm like, okay, we're learning about India. It's a math lesson tied into India. I'm going to come in as Mr. Shah. Hello, I am Mr. Shah from India. The whole outfit, everything. I'm like, in my country, we do not wear our shoes inside. Let me take off my shoes. Okay. And we learn some math. And like 20 minutes later, I'm like, okay, where are my shoes? Who has taken my shoes? Okay, so I had to get it. Again, lose the India voice. I didn't lose it enough, early enough. But anyway, security guard got me to shoes eventually. But again, these books taught me, like, okay, make the child responsible for their actions. I'm like, that's good. That's good. And so I'm talking to the kids one time, one of my little speeches. I'm like, you know, it's like sixth grade class. I'm like, y'all, given the peer pressure, you're not, like, owning up to your own decision. You're letting other people influence your decisions you make. At the same time, I was wearing very tight pants. And I heard one of the kids in there, there's a lot of pressure going on in those pants right now. So all these strategies are not working. But you know what? These kids, I'm starting to learn, they come from these really tough backgrounds. And, like, just even today, this kid who's, like, one of my hardest students I'm working with, who I hear her screaming, cursing out a teacher in the hallway. I'm on my break. She comes in my room, like, tears streaming down her face. And I just feel like, you know, I'm glad she's coming to me. And, like, it's amazing. They'll tell you they hate you to your face. And 20 seconds later, they'll hug you in that, like, moment. And I think it's teaching me what they need and what they're missing at home. And the giving tree at the end, if you know the story, it's a stump. And the little boy's like, he's an old man. And I was like, I just need a place to rest. And the tree's like, okay, just come sit and rest. And I want to be that. I don't want to say to the kids, come sit and rest, because that's weird. But I do want to say, you know, if you need a hug, if you need love, I want to give that for you, even though I cannot control this classroom. So I hope I can give that to you. Thank you.
You're listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. It's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. I'm your host, Jamie Jay, and I'm here in the studio with Elizabeth Perez Luna, and this is our Ode to Teachers. You know, Elizabeth, when we talk about teachers that had an influence, I think the most influential teacher for me was Miss Isherwood. I was in elementary school, and I was the kid who didn't have a mommy or daddy. And Miss Isherwood, she really embraced me and took an interest in my education. She'd give me special attention at school to make sure I did well. And after school, Miss Isherwood would come and get me and take me to her house, show me books, and really introduce me to a love of education. And on holidays, she'd give me presents. That kind of love and care above and beyond the job really made a difference for me.
What a great teacher you had. You know, I really think that, like you, most kids and parents have special memories, especially, you know, that first day of school, our first step towards independence, when each of us embarks on this endless voyage filled with adventures, pitfalls, and moments of inspiration and light and love.
Speaking of pitfalls, here's the story Philadelphia School Superintendent William Height told us about one of his early school days.
I was just like your typical boy in elementary school. And it was West End Elementary School, the West End part of Richmond. and we were going out to recess, and recess was on an asphalt playground, and the school was one of these old schools, like a lot of them here in Philadelphia, and there was about 25, 30 steps. And so I chose to go flying out the door, trying to jump all of the steps to the bottom. And if there were 20 steps, I jumped 19. I hit the last step and broke my ankle. And I remember my dad showing up and putting me on his shoulders. And I had to, he walked me home on his shoulders. And so that was my memory about school. And West End is no longer a school now. The school closed. It's become a retirement facility. And they still have that beautiful set of stairs on the front. And every time I ride by that school on Idlewood Avenue, I see those stairs. And I remember that incident when I wanted to jump all of the stairs. And I remember my teacher at the time just looking at me going, "What were you thinking?" So that was that's my memory about elementary school. And that was the one time, you know, pain has this way of reminding you of stupid things you've done. And that was one of the first stupid things that I can recall doing. And as a result, I had a fractured ankle and had to go home on my dad's shoulders.
That was Dr. William Height, superintendent of the Philadelphia School District.
You know, when you speak of the people that carried us, really carried us through this journey, there were dozens of teachers who guided us. And just as some students find school to be a difficult and endless grind, there are also teachers who figured out along the way that it might be a little bit too much to bear. It might be.
I sometimes felt that I couldn't set good boundaries, that kids were sort of hanging around all the time and telling me things about their personal lives that I didn't always know how to respond to.
That's Marjorie Winther. We'll hear her story in a minute. She was one of the teachers and storytellers in a roundtable conversation about the world of teaching, and we included it in a companion podcast. She spoke of the emotional challenges teachers face when they confront the limitations of how much they can do for their students.
I think for me, the struggle was not compassion, but to harden my heart a little bit. Because I remember this one kid, I was student teaching, it was my first year, and it was in the Englewood neighborhood in Chicago, which is very poor. And this kid, seventh grade, he had this sneakers where the top had separated from the bottom. And Chicago's very cold and snowy and slushy, and he never missed a day. And you would always hear him sort of flopping down the hall with his shoe coming off and snow and ice getting in his shoe. And I was a new teacher, and I was trying a lot of different activities. And my last day, I gave the kids an evaluation, what did you like? And I listed everything. And this little boy, he wrote in just big letters, "I liked everything. I liked everything we did." And just the thought of this little boy with these cold, cold shoes, like, I cried for days. I cried for days. And I don't know how to be in that situation and have the right amount of compassion. I just don't.
You mean you want to reduce your level of compassion?
Toughen up, you know, because what could I do? I could show him how to make an egg in a jar, you know, these Mr. Wizard science secrets, but I couldn't get him out of poverty.
Yet nothing could stop Marjorie from teaching for more than 20 years. As she tells in her story from the first person art stage, she goes from a disaster with fire to a revelation also born in fire.
So 50% of all teachers burn out in the first year, it turns out. 50%. And when you ask them why, it's not because the kids are bad and it's not because of the low pay. It's because you're on your own, you're all alone, and you don't know what to do. There is no support, you don't know what to do. My first year of teaching, I accidentally set a little boy on fire. I didn't
set him on fire. He caught fire. Let me back up. This was 1981. I taught seventh grade science to like fire cracking, throwing little doofy kids. And, you know, I had the right philosophy. I knew that kids could achieve. And I had the right theories that you had to keep them engaged. You had to do hands-on science. So I ran through like every hands-on science experiment that I knew, which was great until the third week when I was out of ideas and they were still there. So I told them that they were the gifted class and that they had to design their own activities. And I gave them my copy of Mr. Wizard Science Secrets. And they decided to make a spontaneous combustion chamber. Now, if you're imagining a science lab with like beakers and a fume hood, like get that picture out of your mind right now. This was public education in the Reagan era. You know, we had egg cartons, string, and imagination. So the kids made the chamber out of a coffee can and some all-purpose flour and a candle. Now, again, remember this was the 80s. This was when America had waged a war on hair. Do you remember, like if you were white, you had to like spray it and gel it and, you know, make it stick up like Bananarama. And if you were black, you had to like goo it up and so it would like be these drippy little ringlets like Michael Jackson. So my point is, in the 80s, people were flammable. So little Robert Rydell, you know, comes up, he's got this chair, he blows through the tube, and what was supposed to happen was the lid was supposed to pop off and, you know, a lot of noise, yay, fun, science. But what did happen was like a lick of flame like shot out and it touched it and he like went up, you know, like an oily rag on a stick, you know. Like he looked like the townspeople in the monster movies with the torches and but like they didn't cover this in N315, you know. So I'm like running out, like banging it out and banging. And the good thing was it was actually a very low temperature fire. Like Robert didn't even know he was on fire. He was like, because you know, I looked up later, like the flash point of like Jerry Curl goo is like 58 degrees. I mean, like it's a wonder people weren't just like bursting into flames on like crisp autumn mornings. So I was worried that I'd get in trouble, but I didn't because the kids didn't tell anyone because they all wanted to do it again. So let me get you prepared because the second fire of my first year of teaching was a little more serious. And what had happened was the principal called me in and said, would you take the seventh graders on a week-long field trip to an archaeological dig site in southern Illinois? Because by this time, she had heard they were the gifted class. So I'm like, yeah, of course I will. That's a week. I don't have to figure out what to do with them. So off we go, southern Illinois, little tiny town. I've got these African-American kids. There's nice Jewish teacher, and, you know, we're all listening to Rock Lobster and having a good time. Until we got up in the morning and found someone had burned a cross on our lawn. Quiet, dude. It's like all fun and games until somebody burns a cross. So the mayor of the town comes by and he goes, you know, I want to reassure you we're going to do an investigation. I'm like, really? An investigation? There's 328 people in this town. I think you need to call in Mr. Tibbs. And, you know, he goes, I think it was kids, it was a prank, hate crime, you know, fine line, you know, but whatever. So the kids are freaking out, and I'm trying to keep it together, and I'm like, we're going to have a good time. Every time they hear a noise, this is going on. We're there for a week. They're, like, freaking out. They're screaming. They're huddling with me, and I'm like, look, we're not going to do this. We're going to learn some archaeology. We're going to have a good time. Well, I'm not going to put up with this. So I put them in a row. Oh, well, here we go. Put them in a row. I said, look. Who here is ready to rise above their fear? And the kids were kind of quiet, and I waited, and finally somebody, little Melanie McLean, raised her hand, and then the other kid raised their hand, the other kid, and we could go, we're going to rise above our fear. And we start walking through the town to the little dining hall, and it starts to drizzle, and this little seventh grade girl starts singing the song from Carousel, "You'll Never Walk Alone," you know that song, "When you walk through a storm, keep your head up high, and don't be afraid of the dark." And then all the kids joined in. They knew this song from an assembly. And they're walking through this town and they're singing. And the people in the town started coming out of their houses. And when the kids went by, they were clapping. And I was so proud. And I realized then that they were the gifted class. And I realized that I wasn't in it alone and that I wasn't going to burn out.
After teaching for more than 20 years, Marjorie has gone on to use her skills at the Philadelphia Gas Works Company, where she does corporate training.
What most teachers know is that kids are resilient. And if you do your job well, you can help them thrive in spite of adversity. Teachers use their creativity and ingenuity to solve problems. And they're really, really aware of time passing and what could be lost if the students don't learn enough to get ahead.
Yeah, you're right. You know, for me, education was always a way to control my life after I finished school. So it's really a race against time and against the sort of neglect fueled by budget limitations and administrative changes. It's easy for politicians and policymakers to say education is at the top of their priorities. That's a no-brainer, but you know, we all know there are different ways of defining priorities, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. I agree with you.
So let's go back to another teacher, Anissa Weinraub. Anissa gets her inspiration from, let's say, a non-traditional career counselor. Here's Anissa Weinraub.
So, I am a Philly public high school English teacher. Holler, thank you. Appreciate it. And, you know, I have been accused of using some rather unconventional teaching methods in my day. One of my very favorites is dream interpretation. I have my students kind of journal their dreams to me, and then dreamdictionary.com, and I interpret them for them. And I don't know how many of you kind of engage in dream interpretation with adolescents, but they kind of run into three general categories: identity crisis, emotional upheaval, and wet. And yeah, so, you know, and as an English teacher, I'm always like, oh, your imagery, it's so vivid and sticky, but honestly, be glad I take that one for the team and you guys don't have to read those. So yeah, whatever. Okay, so I have some out there teaching techniques. But I think it's because I have some out there teachers of my own. My favorite of which is my psychic, Cosmic Jackie. She's like 4 feet tall, like old school South Philly Italian. She has like a piercing guttural guffaw of a laugh and speaks primarily in metaphor. She can read your chart, access your aura, talk to your spirit guides, talk to other people's spirit guides that just kind of randomly are in the room. And as a psychic, she's always on point. Basically, what I'm saying is I love her and I will follow her to the end of time. So, a few years ago, I was in a really miserable place. I was teaching at a school and I just didn't like it. I went for a reading. She said, "You need to break a contract, dig up the carpet, find a path where there is no path, and find a back door." She said, "When I go through that back door, she sees me surrounded with Danishes and brownies." Baked goods is like a metaphor she uses with me a lot, and I just interpret it to mean like really good curriculum or something. And she said she saw me with a really big smile on my face, and there was music and lights everywhere and a gleeful marching band of students filling the space. So I interpreted this all to mean I should definitely quit my job and I'd be fine. And so I did. And literally 3 days later, I'm saying in the dead of winter, in the middle of a school year, I got called into a new school that I was like, oh, this is a much better fit. My psychic is on point. I guess that's why she's a psychic. I hope she thinks knows I'm talking about her right now. So first day I'm there, I'm signing paperwork in the principal's office, and she kind of gives me a little once over, looks me up and down, and says, "You'll do. Yeah, you'll do just fine. You seem like a real creative type." And I was like, "Ooh, how validating. She really sees me." And she says, "Yeah, the band teacher quit today. Figure something out." I was like, "Will do, boss." Enter the band kids. "Hi, everyone. I'm your new teacher, Ms. Weinraub, and this is now expressive arts class. We're going to be expressing ourselves. We started with some theater improv games, which they were so good at. We moved on to some storytelling exercises, which, you know, they were a little less enthusiastic for. And then I was like, "It's time for a poetry slam." And they were like, "No more." One kid was like, "I don't want to do this anymore. I just want my flute." Now, I don't know about you, but when a 6-foot-tall teenage boy from Southwest Philly says he just wants his flute, you better go find his flute. So when the band teacher quit, they went into like hyper survival mode at the school. And, you know, they locked everything away. So they told me I just had to find the guy with the key to get the instruments. So I, like, wound my way through a labyrinth, which is an old Philly public high school, until I found the guy with the key. And then I used one of my many tools in my teacher toolkit, my short skirt, to get him to open the door for me and get the instruments, which, please don't judge. I have also dated someone for, like, months longer than I really wanted to, just because they could get me free reams of office paper. And don't even get me started about what I pull at Staples. You know what I'm saying? It's public education. We're in budget cuts, okay? So you gotta do what you gotta do. So, okay, my students are reunited with their long-lost bassoons and alto saxophones, and they run upstairs to the auditorium to get situated. They sort of set up in an orchestral formation, I assume, and start kind of tuning to an E or something. I don't really know. I don't know how to play any instruments. And I stand before them, my band. I say, "Guys, before we start, I just have a few words to say." So they look up at me expectantly. "I could definitely be your drama teacher, okay? I could probably even be your choir teacher. But I stand before you today, your band teacher." Now, my psychic told me that this was going to happen, but at the time, I figured it was just a metaphor. But as I see all of you before me, I realize she was telling me the truth. And they look up at me like, "What is this white lady talking about?" So what I'm saying is, I'm going to need a lot of leadership from you. Can you do that? And they all kind of boop, boop, boop with their assent. I said, "All right, Zayshawn, give us a count," or whatever. "A 5, a 6, a 5, 6, 7, 8. And miraculously, the saints came marching in. And the biggest smile spread out across my face, just like Cosmic Jackie said it would. Thank you.
Anissa Weinraub is an educator, organizer, performer, and clearly a full-time pep rally in her 11th year teaching in the Philadelphia School District. You've been listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. It's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. Common Space includes this broadcast, live events, and additional audio available online. Common Space airs on WHYY the last Sunday of each month. Don't forget to check us out. Remember to tune in. It's also available anytime online at acommonspace.org. That's acommonspace.org, where you'll also find 2 monthly podcasts that dive deeper into the topics presented here, show transcripts, live event schedules, and ways to share your stories with us.
Common Space is produced by Mike Villers. The Common Space team includes Sridevi Sripathi, Dan Gashevsky, Becca Jennings, Jen Cleary, Ali L'Esperance, and Neil Barton. Our studio engineers were Al Banks and Diana Martinez. Jamie Brunson is the host and co-writer. And I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna, executive producer and lead writer.
So from all of us at Common Space, we salute teachers and storytellers. Those people who, as Dr. Height says, show both passion and compassion in their work.
Thanks for listening.